I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. For 50 years, from the late 1920s to the late 1970s, the Steel Pier in Atlantic City featured diving horses who jumped from a small platform into a tank of water 40 feet below with a female rider, a so-called diving girl, on their back. It was the most popular attraction at that amusement park and was finally halted amid charges of animal cruelty. Cynthia Branigan was a young girl visiting Atlantic City with her parents in 1964 who never forgot seeing those diving horses. After the act was shut down, the horses were sent to the auction block facing near certain death at the slaughterhouse. A grown-up Cynthia Branigan was at an auction to buy one of the diving horses, Gamel. She's written a book about how she rescued him, and he frankly rescued her, the last diving horse in America. It's about the history of diving horses, her relationship with Gamel, and her years rescuing other animals, including thousands of racing greyhounds. She founded Make Peace with Animals Incorporated and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Cynthia Branigan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
You know, I hadn't looked at some of those photographs and even video of these diving horses at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City. I watched a lot of them in preparation for the show today. And I have to say that it is shocking that that was legal for so many years.
Yeah, it actually started in 1894, and then they went up 60 feet in the air.
Wow.
But they scaled it back to 40. But I can't imagine 40 feet and 10 feet of water. That's like jumping into a puddle, basically. You know, 10 feet of water is nothing. And yet, of all the years the act, because it started before Atlantic City, in all those years, there was one death, and that was a horse drowned.
Wow.
In the Pacific Ocean. But other than that, there were no broken legs. There was nothing.
Seems improbable.
Yes.
You write about being a little girl. Your parents, actually your dad, was at the Democratic National Convention.
Yes.
In Atlantic City, 1964. You go with your mom to see the diving horses. What was your impression as a little girl?
Yeah, I was 11, and Atlantic City itself was kind of a shock to my system. We went to Cape May, which you probably know it's still sedate. Atlantic City was anything but, plus with the convention ears there and every attraction known to man, and the Beatles, we can't forget them.
Of course.
I didn't even know that the Beatles appeared in person the day after we left, but all I wanted was to see A Hard Day's Night. But I had been on the beach all day, and I had a case of sunstroke and just excitement and eating all kinds of garbage food because my mother, she let me do whatever.
Didn't.
And we were just about to leave the Steel Pier that night when I remembered the horses, and I started to cry. I've got to see the horses. So we did. And I'm not sure why to this day. It was kind of a life-changing experience for me. And maybe it was the bad food and the sun and the excitement. But just that image burned into my brain of the horse suspended in midair. And I had a preposterous thought for an 11-year-old, which was, what does this mean? I don't know why I would think that any more than what does a roller coaster mean or anything. But I did, and the image would pop up in my mind from time to time for years after. And then, of course, who knew that in the end I would wind up with one of them.
Well, you write, the horse was now in complete control. He could have sailed forward but seemed in no rush. He was the star and would do things on his terms. He lingered and surveyed the audience as if taking stock, seeing how many were in the crowd that night and making sure we were paying attention. He gazed out at the ocean, then back again at the crowd. This is a horse fully in control.
I think so.
Of
yes.
That experience, that moment.
Yes, he wasn't quivering or trying to back down or rear up or anything like that. He was in show business. That's really what it boils down to. And the horses that were chosen for this act, not all of them passed the test. And the first requirement was you have to like water.
As a horse, lead them to water, as you write, right?
That's right. And that was number one. And if they shied away from water or showed any discomfort, that was the end. Then they went on to something else, a riding horse or whatever. But then they started training them. They would just have a jump, and they'd lead them over the jump, and there'd be water on the other side, just, wow, you know, a foot deep. And then they would raise the jump and kept raising the jump. If you look at the photos of the diving horses, it looks like there's a platform beneath the main platform. And there is. That was 20 feet high. And that would be part of their training. So they'd go up a ramp, take a left turn, and go to the 20 feet high platform, and then jump into the water. Mm. And once they successfully managed that, then they'd go up another 20 feet, and the girl would jump on their back. And sometimes the girl couldn't even get on fast enough. They'd jump on their own. But other times she'd be sitting on there 10 or 15 minutes while they, you know, sort of swayed back and forth, sniffed the salt air. I don't know what, but they did. But the night I saw it, it was a standard experience. He got to the top. She jumped on. He looked around maybe 5 minutes and then
off he went.
Took off.
Wow. There's a really interesting history of diving horses in America. It goes back to this guy you write about, Doc Carver. He was a Texas sharpshooter. This is what, the mid to late 19th century?
He was born in 1861.
Right.
So, yes, exactly that. And he was originally a dentist, but the sort of have pliers will travel kind of dentist. There was a dental school, and it was right here in Philadelphia, but he didn't go anywhere near there. And but he was kind of a wild man, and for a while he was a scout for buffalo hunts and lived, he said, with several Indian tribes. Whether he did or not remains to be seen, but he was the country's foremost sharpshooter. So he got to show off and wear jackets with fringe. And
this Wild West shows, right?
The Wild West. He went into business with Buffalo Bill Cody, but both men had tremendous egos. Well, that didn't last, I think, a year. And Doc Carver said he was called Doc because he used to be a so-called dentist. So Doc took Cody to court, said he drank up all their profits. I never knew Cody drank, but I think I do now. And Doc started his own show where he would showcase his sharpshooting skills, but he wanted more. Yeah. And then he thought up the diving horse act.
And in Atlantic City, and it was there from what, the 1920s through really most of the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it ended in 1978 at the Steel Pier, but it started there in 1929, 2 years after he died. He had two troops of horses, one west of the Mississippi and one east of the Mississippi. He also took the horses into Mexico and Canada. They were all over. Everybody saw the diving horses. But after he died, there was the manager of the act and two women whose names are very difficult to keep straight, Sonora and Lorena. And everybody assumed the last name of Carver, but in fact, none of them were Carvers.
But they just appropriated that name?
Yeah, the Flying Walendas and that sort of thing.
Right.
So,
right.
And they decided Atlantic City was the place to go, and they would jump, the horses would jump from Memorial Day to Labor Day four times, sometimes five times a day, 6 days a week.
As you mentioned, and it's sort of shocking and hard to imagine that more animals were not hurt, or even riders hurt. I mean, here you're jumping into a relatively small and not so deep pool of water.
Well, a woman who interviewed me recently was looking at the photos, and she's a real horse person, unlike myself. I still consider myself very much a novice, but she noticed that the horses extended their front legs, and that's how they broke their fall.
Instead of rather than landing feet first.
Yeah, they didn't go like that. They extended their front legs.
Wow.
That's her theory. But the women were hurt. All of them over the years at least had a broken arm or a broken rib. But the horses, they seem to have escaped unscathed. The SPCA would be there often, make surprise visits. Sometimes they were certain that they were whipped or beaten, or that it was sort of a trap door and they just had to jump because the door was pulled back. Mm-hmm. But none of it was true. They really did it.
And yet it was shut down. I mean, there were charges, I guess, of, I don't know if they were proven, but certainly animal cruelty. And when, I guess, animal activism became to come into its own, the diving horse was a target.
That happened later in, I think it was 1993. But the act actually closed in 1978 because the steel pier was sold to Resorts International. And they didn't want anything to do with diving horses. And the people, there were three businessmen, and I didn't name them. Again, I'm trying to be nice. but the three businessmen who bought the steel pier, they didn't care. They were chattel, you know, just let them go. Resorts International certainly didn't care about taking on, they would probably have said, three old nags. And there was an old man who in it, Atlantic City, who used to board the horses on the off season. So they sold, they didn't even give them to him. They sold them
for a couple thousand, right?
$100 a piece, because that $300 made all the difference to Resorts. I don't mind saying Resorts, you know, what the hey. But, and the old man immediately turned around and sold them. And that's when one of them went almost certainly to a slaughterhouse, and that happens to have been the one who I saw that summer of 1964, yeah. And his name was Powderface.
In fact, you were working for the Fund for Animals, Cleveland Amory's group, and got a phone call, and someone said, you got better do something about this horse.
He was out of the country lecturing on the QE2, and for reasons unknown, put me in charge, and I answered the phone, and it was an irate woman, and she said, I want to talk to Cleveland. I want to talk to him now. And I sort of pictured her, you know, pounding her fist on the desk. And I said, well, he's not here right now. He's out of the country. Can I take a message? And, you know, she made it clear this was an emergency and who's in charge. And I had to say I was, gulp. And then she told me that this horse was going on the auction block. And I think she said one's already in a can of dog food. And one was sold to a woman as a riding horse. We wound up with her eventually, too, by the way. But Gamal was going to be sold to the highest bidder. And that just was impossible. I don't know if Cleveland had said no, I don't know what I would have done. Sold blood, sold my car, but I was going to get that horse.
Well, let's pick up on that after this very short break. That is Cynthia Branigan. She's got a new book. It's called The Last Diving Horse in America, Rescuing Gamal. That's the horse she rescued, and other animals. She has helped to rescue thousands of racing greyhounds. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Cynthia Branigan about how rescuing a diving horse from the Atlantic City Steel Pier, how it changed her life and led to rescuing other animals, including thousands of racing greyhounds. And again, her book is titled The Last Diving Horse in America. So you hear about Gamal, you get this phone call. You go to an auction. It's in New Jersey.
Yes.
And you see him. And as you write about seeing him at this auction, the kind of presence and charisma that he had. Help us. I guess this is your first sort of meeting of Gamal, was like.
He was in a stall that was bedecked with red, white, and blue crepe paper. There was a big crowd around him. I could hardly get a peek. I wanted to, but I couldn't. But I kind of looked, and he looked right back at everybody, You know, he knew he was somebody, absolutely. But when he was brought out into the ring, just like the horses did at the top of the ramp, he scanned the audience, you know, the bidders, to see how many were there that night. Were they, well, I guess I'm anthropomorphizing here, but were they worthy of him? And certainly some were not, because in the early going of the bidding, the so-called killers, which are the ones buying horses for slaughter.
Is that what they're called? They're called the killers?
Colloquially, yes, the killers were in the back of the room. And, you know, they were used to the routine. I was trembling, but they were used to it. And they would just, you know, give a little nod or, you know, one index finger, and the auctioneer would know they wanted it, doing it in $50 increments. Mm-hmm. But when it reached something like $500, $550, something like that, they dropped out, because you could tell when they were looking at the horse, not just Gamal, but all of them, they were figuring out how much, this is horrible, how much meat on the bone, because that's where their money came from.
The bigger the horse, yeah, the more the meat.
Yeah. And so they dropped out. And then I was dueling with a couple of people. One said they wanted to put him on display. Well, what did that mean exactly? And somebody else, they bid a little while. They said they felt sorry for him. And who wouldn't? But were they really equipped to take care of him? But I was going to get him. I knew that. And as I said in the book, I'm pretty sure I bid against myself a few times because I just kept raising my hand. I was shaking. I wasn't the most confident person to begin with. And then there was a lot riding on this, no pun intended. You know, I had to get him. So I did.
Yeah.
$2,600. That was about $2,000 above his retail value.
Well, but, I mean, how prepared were you to take care of a horse? Well, I mean, I know you bought him for the fun for animals.
Yes.
But nonetheless.
Well, I had made arrangements beforehand to take him to a farm just outside of New Hope. A woman named Wendy McCook ran the farm, and he was to be there just for 1 month, and then he was going to be sent down to the fund's brand new ranch in Texas. But the 1 month turned into 9 years because they didn't have their fencing finished yet. But Wendy certainly taught me about horses and what all those strange terms mean and everything about that. So he was in good hands, and I was learning. And he didn't stay there for 9 years. He only stayed there for about a year. He went on to other farms. But by then, I pretty much knew the routine.
And you developed this really deep love bond connection with Gamal. I mean, it seemed, at least in the beginning, maybe a little more one-sided in that you were the kind of pursuer of this relationship.
That's a very good way to put it, yes. Maybe I forced myself on him a little bit.
Did you need him?
Well, I guess I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. I did need him, but I wanted him to know how much I cared for him. And with my dog, I had a border collie named Stockbridge at the time, and I could hug him and kiss him. I had cats. I could hug them and kiss them. So I tried that with Gamal, and he wasn't having it. I mean, he was a tough, crusty old guy. But as time went on, it changed. And, you know, he would nuzzle me and lean against me. I mean, it didn't happen overnight, clearly, but he changed. And I respected his boundaries, too.
And it seemed, I mean, I've ridden only a little bit in my life, but there are just these moments of being with a horse where there's the smell, their beauty. I mean, I just think it's the most gorgeous animal just to look at. And something about just the feel of their face, that is, it's so sensual and so tactile.
It is. And he was, I had been told he wasn't the biggest horse in the world and he wasn't the most beautiful horse in the world. But to me, he was. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't believe that he was in my care and that life that had seen so much. He came from Texas. He had been in a rodeo. He did barrel racing. His diving horse trainer said that he could turn on a dime and give change. I like that expression.
Wow.
But he saw plenty in his life, and all the girls that rode on his back, and the people who worked at the steel pier, and the sight and the sound of the ocean and the scent of the salt air. And, you know, if he was a person, he could write probably a better book than I could.
Well, that's interesting. But did you think of him as an abused animal?
I expected to see that, and I did not. I mean, I thought the poor old guy.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the worst abuse was the fact that they discarded those three for no reason. I mean, I could get irate about it right now because they were beloved in Atlantic City and beyond, and there were many people who would have either taken them for free or paid for them and given them a good life. And nobody thought, gee, aren't there some horse people out? I don't understand that to this day.
One listener wants to mention that horses can only go up steps. They can't go down them. I don't know enough about horses to be able to respond to that.
Well, that's certainly true. They could not back down, but the ramp, if they made a tight enough turn, they could have turned around and gone back down.
Right. I mean, I've been down a cliff on a horse, so it's not like they can't go down, but I think they were talking about steps.
Yes, but it was a carpeted ramp that they would run up to the top platform.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, talking with Cynthia Branigan today on Radio Times. She's got a new book. It's called The Last Diving Horse in America, Rescuing Gamel and Other Animals, Lessons in Living and Loving. And we've been talking about this really popular attraction in Atlantic City for a lot of the 20th century, the diving horses there. And if you remember seeing them, we would love to hear from you. Any remembrances or questions or comments? You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Would you say Gamel, this horse that you rescued, kind of gave you a mission for rescuing other animals, gave you a purpose in life?
Well, yes. I mean, I already was dedicated to alleviating the suffering of animals. That's why I originally volunteered for the Fund for Animals and then was hired full time. But how I was going to help animals was an open question for quite a few years.
Like, and how do you do this thing, right?
Yes. But having Gamal and developing that relationship with him, a lot of it involved confidence. He would give me confidence that I didn't have. At the same time, the fund was rescuing burros from the Grand Canyon. Burros are the same as donkeys, but they're not the same as mules. A lot of people mix them up. But they were left behind in the Grand Canyon by prospectors who went out west and, you know, in search of gold. They went to Death Valley, Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico, and they just left the animals either when they found gold or when they didn't.
Wow. They've been there for a long time, obviously.
Yes, and then they started reproducing, and the Park Service said, well, that can't be. They're eating native plants. We'll have to shoot them. Oh, great idea. And if you ever knew Cleveland Amory or heard of him, he was never going to stand for that, never. So he took them to court. The judge issued an injunction and said, you have 30 days to show me there's another way. And he did it.
How did he do it?
All credit goes to Cleveland for that and his will and determination. But all of those animals could not be adopted either near the Grand Canyon, not a highly populated area, of course, or at the ranch in Texas, because in the end there were, 6,000 from all the various locations out west, 6,000 burros and 4,000 mustangs, and there were some pigs and goats, too, thrown in just for I don't know why. So they came, and he had to figure out what to do with them, and so he put me in charge of the adoption program. It was another one of those moments, much like the phone call about Gamal, where I thought, gee, why me? I don't know what I'm doing. But again, that goes back to Gamal and the confidence. So he said, I'm sending you 40 burros. Just 40
like
burros?
That.
I had only met one burro up until that point. That was the one that we took on Good Morning America, but then 40 more. So I found another farm that had more facilities, and Gamal moved, and some of the other animals I acquired along the way, because I can't say no. And then after that 40, another 40, then people started volunteering their farms all over the country. So I would go out and interview the people, make sure the facilities were adequate, have a press conference, and go on to the next to the next farm.
So you found homes for, what, thousands of burros?
6,000 and 4,000 Mustangs.
And 4,000 Mustangs, wow. And were there diving burros for a while?
Well, Doc hated the fact that people were always trying to copy his act. And after he died, someone down in Florida came up with diving mules. And they also had ponies, a dog, and a monkey. Mm. And the monkey would hold on to the mane of the pony, and they'd jump off. You know, it was maybe not 20 feet high, 15 feet high into a tank. And that was really horrible. I mean, there wasn't even an attempt of a veneer of awe or wonder. So I think if I had seen that when I was 11, it would not have had the same effect. I would want to have gotten out of there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, your love for animals seems to run pretty deep. You write a little bit about your childhood growing up. You were an only child. You had some...
Still am.
And you still are. I guess it is. You both were and are an only child. And had cats, not dogs. Your dad thought dogs were too much work. And they are more work, I think, than cats.
Sure.
But nonetheless, you had cats who seemed to be a confidant for you. I mean,
yes.
As you describe it, not in like great detail, but perhaps a lonely child. I mean, a child that needed a friend.
Well, that's fair to say. I mean, I didn't have cousins who lived nearby, or I mean, it was just my mother, my father, and me.
Yeah.
And books. There were always lots of books. That was good. And the cats.
And the cats. Right. You were sent for a time to a boarding school in, I guess, in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes.
You're looking at me like, grr. And it was a very bad match for you, correct?
Yes. My father thought that this was going to, I guess, make a lady out of me.
Were you not a lady?
Well, I was a tomboy, what they called a tomboy, climbing trees, and I had other little creatures besides cats, and, you know, just wanted to be left alone, really, but he wanted more than that from me, so he sent me up there, and I think what I mostly learned was how to swear like a sailor. I developed a terrific vocabulary along those lines. You know, and I rebelled against it and was constantly in detention and berated and so on. And after the 3 years of it, I put my foot down and said, no more, I won't go back. Yeah. So then I went to a lovely place.
But that was, I mean, obviously a tough time, a young girl by themselves trying to make it through what sounded like a pretty wicked boarding school.
It was pretty wicked. And this was also the 60s. So the world was exploding, and, you know, I was able to listen to music, Donovan and the Beatles, and I had all these ideas. And then, I mean, I think of the headmistresses as always having a riding crop in their hands, even though they didn't, but it was like that.
Right. So you felt like, if not certain punishment, like just had to sort of abide by these very strict rules.
I found ways around it. That's another story.
And that's another story. Here's an email from Dan. Is it true that the wife of Gene Hart, the Philadelphia Flyer announcer, was one of the women that rode the horse at the Steel Pier? Do you know?
Yes.
That's true.
That's absolutely true. And
oh, wow.
I'm sorry I can't think of her name, but it's absolutely true. And I believe she was diving for a number of years.
You do write about several women. I mean, they had Sonora, you mentioned, and Sonora and Lenora, right?
Lorena.
Carver.
Yes. Quote unquote.
Quote unquote. And these were pretty famous, I guess, diving girls.
They were the most famous, certainly. And Sonora co-wrote her autobiography called A Girl and Her Five Brave Horses. And it's about how one time when she was diving, she didn't turn her head quickly enough and the retinas on her eyes detached and she became blind. And the twist is that she loved diving so much that she kept doing it. So they were there, and she and her husband were there until 1942 when they retired. But then the act went on with other people, including Lorena Carver.
And Sonora was, so she was a blind diving girl.
Yes, she was.
Wow.
And then they made a movie out of that book that many people, girls, I think in particular, sort of early teen girls watched called, Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken, 1990 or 91, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it says, based on a true story. Well, she did go blind. That part's true.
But that part's true. Other parts may be embellished. And Lorena Carver, I mean, you write about her as well.
Yes. I do feel that Lorena was kind of left behind. And she had a very strong personality, from what I understand. And I believe she was the original diving girl, 1904. She was the first one. And she was brought back at the end to manage the act at the Steel Pier. She was the old lady who would give a carrot to the horse after its dive. Mm. But, kind of a very sad story that the pier was sold. She got on a train with her little miniature poodle, Babette, and she was half blind from diving, blind, and took a train down to Florida, lived in a mobile home, and died alone. I mean, that's like an Eleanor Rigby kind of a story, but I felt her character needed to be fleshed out a little.
Sarah Hart is the former diving horse rider, widow of Philadelphia Flyers announcer Jean Hart. Yes. We got that from Paige Murray Bessler, our producer here on Radio Times. We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation talking with Cynthia Brannigan. She's got a new book, The Last Diving Horse in America, Rescuing Gamal and Other Animals, Lessons in Living and Loving. And we're going to carry on this conversation, and we want to hear from you. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Cynthia Brannigan about how rescuing a diving horse who performed at the Atlantic City Steel Pier changed her life. We've been also talking about her involvement in the Fund for Animals and rescuing other animals, including thousands of racing greyhounds and wild horses and also burros, kind of a motley crew there. And she's got a new book called The Last Diving Horse in America. I do want to go back to your relationship with Gamal. And you write about, and we sort of referenced this earlier, about how he taught you sort of how to be quiet, how to be in the moment, how to, frankly, to how to breathe. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. I think I said that there were kind of two parts to my relationship with him, and one was the confidence building, and then that was really important because the burros were coming, so I had to learn that one fast. But the other part, I would say, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, it was almost a spiritual connection. And I think I and many people, most people, have a lot of chatter going on in their head at all times. And I would sometimes verbalize it to him. You won't believe what so-and-so did to me, or why can't I? And it on and on. And he would just do something, which I'll explain, that absolutely changed my life. He would rest his head on my shoulder, and he'd have that big cheek next to my cheek, and he'd just breathe, and he would stand there and breathe. Now, when you're talking to a person and telling them your problems or even your triumphs, they say something back and there's a conversation. But of course, there was not a conversation with Gamal, and it was actually deeper.
Wow.
Because I would just feel, I'd maybe have my hand against his ribs, and I could feel the expansion and contraction from breathing. And then I would feel it on my cheek, and I could hear it in my ear. And unconsciously, I just started to breathe in exactly the same way. And I have since then have done some study about this, and it's a type of yogic breathing. I think it's called pranayama, but it would be inhaling and then just a gentle exhale. So there wasn't any huffing or puffing. I mean, that's when I first started to try and imitate him. There would be huffing and puffing involved. But eventually I learned, and the whole world changed because of that. Things calmed down. Yes, I had an inner confidence, but I also had a broader understanding of the world, and I would say a lot of little petty things that seem so terribly important were absolutely unimportant. If you're looking at, you know, the cosmic picture, it's nothing. It's so I felt a connection to something beyond this plane of reality.
When you live with animals, you often outlive them. So they die first, I know. This is the sad part, and I've lived with animals my whole life, and I still tear up when I think about certain animals that I just love so much, and I still miss, you know, to this day. Here I am, I'm tearing up as I talk about them. And this happened with Gamal as well, which, you know, this was a horse that, as you write about him, he didn't, like, save your life, but he gave you purpose, and you had a really profound relationship with him, and, you know, he died.
Yes, he kind of died and he kind of didn't, yeah. I think is maybe the best way to put it. He and I were both 26 when we met, which is kind of coincidental and interesting. But, you know, I knew that he was going to predecease me.
Yeah.
But that night after he died, when I went out on the meadow on my property, and I had King at that point, my first greyhound, and I was just beside myself. I didn't think I could live almost because he had become such a strong presence and my guide, my everything. And I just started breathing, you know, it was just instinctive. And I, at first, thought about that act at the steel pier and what did that mean? Because that was sort of the big question of my life right along. And it came to me that what it meant was the horse has to dive. And the horse also had to die and move on. And we all do. But you can't stand on that platform forever. And somehow that was comforting to me because it was the natural order of things.
I mean, as you write about him, and, you know, again, you talked about the danger of anthropomorphizing, but looking at his, I guess, his body language, he seemed to enjoy the diving, right? I mean, that he was a sort of a born performer.
Oh, yes. He was I used to take him into the Delaware River. I used to walk him along the canal, and I found a place. I still think of it as our spot. And he would be eating the grass, but then he started to go in the water, and I thought he was just going to have a few laps, tap it with his paw. But he wanted to swim. He wanted to go. And, of course, we both would have died then. So I had to pull him back. And that was one. I think that was a big test for me. I pulled him back, and he said, okay, I trust you.
Mm. Wow.
Everything changed.
Did you ever ride him?
Once.
Just once.
I went around a ring just to see. But we had a different kind of relationship, and I wasn't then, nor am I now, a writer.
Steve says, can you talk about what became of Gamal? But in the interim then, between the time when you bought him and the time that he died, he lived on various farms, and I guess you live in the New Hope area, so
yes.
in that part of Pennsylvania.
Yes. Well, he had to leave the first place because Cleveland brought in the 40 boroughs.
Cleveland Amory, yeah.
Yes, and Wendy McCook's farm was not set up for that. Most people's aren't. But a friend told me about another farm. It was in New Jersey, but just across the river. And they had turn out sheds out in the pasture, and they had a big barn, and they had indoor riding ring. It was, you would think it was set up for 40 burros, but in fact it wasn't, but it worked out perfectly. But when the influx of burros started to wane, then Cleveland was always watching the bottom dollar, and it was expensive to keep Gamal there, and there were a couple of other animals who were then going to go down to Texas. Finally, they were going to Texas, but he told me I could keep Gamal, but I had to find less expensive lodgings for him, and so I did.
And the farm in Texas was Black Beauty?
Black Beauty farm. Ranch, and now Black it's Beauty called Ranch. Cleveland Amory's Black Beauty Ranch.
Wow. A question from Cletus. I've ridden horses all my life, and I wonder if there was any particular breed that was used for the diving horses.
Oh, that's a good question. Yes. Yeah. Gamal and all of them were quarter horse mixes. So they were small, sturdy, stocky. And in Gamal's case, he also had done other things. I mentioned earlier the barrel racing and so on, but they needed small horses for that act. Right.
Here's a question from Anne. In your years of animal rescue, have you found any similarity of personality in people who have little or no regard for the animals and their suffering? You talk about the killers at the auction, right?
Yeah.
It's
a business, but I think that the people who do mistreat animals are selling themselves short. They could have a wonderful and rich relationship, but they compartmentalize that kind of suffering. Some because they have to, and some, I guess, because they're just too lazy to do anything else. I could also say that people who have pets, companion animals, a lot of them love their animals dearly, but I don't think the animals actually change their lives. But they could if they invested a little more effort. And I'm not talking about frilly collars or bows in their hair. I mean, just being quiet and listening to the animal. And I think most people will find there's a relationship that they didn't know existed before.
I'm not sure how direct a connection is between, you know, child abuse and animal abuse, but I'm sure there's got to be something there.
Definitely. In fact, when the ASPCA in New York was formed by a man named Henry Berg, B-E-R-G-H, it was to prevent cruelty to animals and children because it was known even then, you beat the dog, you beat the horse, you beat the child. It's an awful thing.
It sure is. Here's an email from Simone. I remember seeing the diving horse at the Steel Pier when I was around 10. It was a white horse.
Yeah, that was the one. That's the one I saw, too. That was Powderface.
Oh. So you, as a young girl, that was the one.
Wow. Which is bitter. That's a bitter pill.
Bitter because just...
Because I would have gotten him, too, and it was too late.
Right. You said there was one horse that died doing this diving?
Yes. Her name was Duchess of Lightning, and I mentioned that they had two troops of diving horses, and the one west of the Mississippi was going to take up residence at a pier near Santa Monica, not Santa Monica, but near there. And they were going to have, for the first time, have the horses jump off the end of the pier into the Pacific Ocean. And the idea was then they'd turn around and swim back to shore. The Steel Pier was a mile long. This wasn't that long, so it wasn't that long a swim. The first horse that tried it, it was just trials, the first one, it worked perfectly. Oh, good, let's have Duchess go. And she jumped off and then panicked because the waves were hitting her in the face. And she didn't know what to do, so she swam out beyond the breakers and drowned.
Oh, goodness.
And they sent out a boat and men, and they went to pull her in, but it was too late. That's a story I wish I didn't know.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. You have also, I guess, rescued and found homes for, 5,500 racing greyhounds?
I've stopped counting, but when it got up to that, I thought, we'll end it there. With Make Peace with Animals, my all-volunteer adoption group.
How long have you been doing that? I know you've written several books about rescuing greyhounds.
I adopted my first greyhound in 1987 and found a home for one in 1988. And then it took off from there. And in fact, it was another one of those phone calls. Somebody said, I understand you find homes for greyhounds. And at that point, it was one. And she said, well, I'm calling from Seabrook, New Hampshire at the track, and we'd like to start sending dogs. And I thought, well, how different could it be from Burroughs? So that's how it happened.
How different was it from Burroughs? Or maybe it wasn't. I don't know.
It was pretty different. Yeah. It was pretty different because I didn't have hands-on experience with 6,000 Burroughs, but I've had hands-on with these greyhounds and the people who adopt them.
Yeah.
And the problems that arise and all of that.
Well, and these are animals. Interesting, and I do want to have you talk about this on the air because I was asking you off the air before we began this interview about greyhound racing today, and you say it's really... It's disappearing.
Yes, it's in its death throes, I think is safe to say, because there are only three tracks left in the country. When I started, there were tracks everywhere, not Pennsylvania, New York, or New Jersey, although there had been from time to time back in the 20s and that sort of thing. But little by little, some of them closed because of lack of business, and then some of them were made illegal, They were shut down. So that happened most recently in Florida. And Florida was, you always associate greyhound racing with Florida. And once that was gone, well, it can't exist as it is now with three tracks. And it is impossible, I think, that new ones will open because of public outcry. Yeah. So,
I mean, I don't know. You know a lot more about racing greyhounds, but the couple that I've met seem so... shy. I don't know if that's sort of part of their personality or whether it's a result of having been raced, I don't know, nearly to death. I don't know.
I don't think that's the case. And they do have a tendency towards shyness and sensitivity. They're that kind of dog. They also have very large eyes, you know, that they kind of, you know, you can read things into them. But I would not call it systematic cruelty. Greyhound racing, but it's also true that many of them were abused, but mostly not.
You also said an interesting thing, which they're seeing some connections, some parallels between greyhounds and horses.
Yes, and that came into play with Gamal and King, because when I first adopted King, he was 10 years old, down in the dumps. He had had several homes before mine, and kind of didn't want to live. And I took him to the farm where Gamal was being boarded. And Gamal was looking for my old dog, Stockbridge, who had just died, and kind of a mess all around. But he looked at King. He looked him up and down. They sniffed, you know, through the fence. And then Gamal ran back and forth. And King perked up. It was an incredible transformation. His ears went up. His head went up because he'd been hanging it. And he knew how to run. And they ran back and forth till they were both winded and happy. And that turned King around completely.
Wow. Well, we have to end our conversation. And my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times. And Cynthia Branigan, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure, really.
Absolutely. And the book is called The Last Diving Horse in America, subtitled Rescuing Gamal and Other Animals, Lessons in Living and Loving. And our guest, Cynthia Branigan, founded Make Peace with Animals. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe, and here's Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones.